Welcome to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Today is Thursday, and that means we start with Taylor Chalstrom.
Hi, this is Taylor. Welcome to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. Today is Tech Thursday, a bi-weekly segment where we cover technological advances in ag. I got the chance to talk with Associate Research Agronomist Elias Gudiero at last month's Crop Consultant Conference about his talk, which included advances his team at UC Riverside is making in artificial intelligence for enhancing management decisions. Here is that interview. Hi, it's Taylor. We're back here with Elia, who just talked about how artificial intelligence might enhance your recommendations as a consultant. Elia, that was the title of your talk. You know, how might AI change the way consultants really do business in the future?
Well, the way I see it as a soil scientist is that we have a lot of information out there from the USDA, NRCS, and we also have a lot of information coming in from satellite sensors that are available from NASA, from the European Space Agency, and private companies such as Planet. And what we are doing is we're looking at these available data sets, some new data that we collect ourselves in the field, and these satellite imageries, and using newer developed data science techniques to enhance the knowledge that is already there about soil properties. So the available soil maps are fairly accurate at the landscape scale. You can look at the average values across a field, and they are fairly on point. But when you look within a field, not so much. But that knowledge is needed to give more information and better information to the growers on where to put their soil sensors, how to better understand differences in yields that they might observe within a single block. So hopefully data science can help us make better sense of like the available data and enhance what all the work that has been done by the UC and the USDA for the past century in their effort of surveying the soils in California and as well in the rest of the US for other agencies that collected those. Yeah.
Okay. If a grower or a consultant wants to take a look at this data, is it all public access, free to use, or is there something you have to pay for, that kind of thing?
No, so any product that we do is generally public access, and they can contact me for more information about like the latest soil properties that were developed by some from our lab and some from the colleagues that I work closely with. Of course, like many people know that the USDA soil maps are available, and there are several platforms that can be used to access those. And hopefully, as soon as we are proceeding with our research at the University of California in Riverside, we can make the newer soil maps available as soon as possible.
Okay. And correct me if I'm wrong, you and UC Riverside mm-hmm. are part of a larger research collaborative looking at this, like you said. Can you tell us a little bit more about that and how it's going up to this point?
Yeah, so we are leading at UC Riverside this multi-state project that looks at the irrigated agriculture across the US Southwest, with a focus on the Colorado River Basin and also the Salinas River Valley here in California. And we're looking at how we can use these daily satellite data at very high resolution to understand how crops are doing in terms of their water needs, nutrient needs, and how they respond to different soil spatial variability that is observed throughout the system. So that then we can perhaps increase the crop production and as well increase the environmental sustainability of agricultural practices throughout the system. We've been working on this for a year. We've collected quite a little bit of data, especially down in the desert in the Yuma area, some in Imperial. And at the moment, we are calibrating models that have already been developed in the past for them to be leveraging this information from daily satellite imagery, which is fairly recent. And for this, we are partnering with Planet Labs, that is a California-based company that has a fleet of hundreds of satellites that monitor the entire planet on a daily scale with a very high resolution, spatial resolution of satellite imagery. We have been working in the field in the past year, despite COVID trying to slow us down And hopefully in the near future, we can start showing some of the results to the growers. And as a matter of fact, we do have a cooperative extension program that will involve growers and communities in California, Arizona, and Colorado, where we talk about sensors in agriculture, precision agriculture, and related topics. And for those events, people can go and visit our website that has a schedule of the upcoming events. And what we're doing in terms to make sure that this knowledge is carried out by the future generations. We have a fellowship for students at UC Riverside and other universities that are collaborating with us, where we pair the students with a faculty mentor, but as well an industry company that works in the ag tech space, and they can work with the university and the company to develop their understanding on how data science can be used to benefit agriculture and growers. So that's about it. We started just this year, and we're going to go for the next 4 years and a half or so. So hopefully we can maximize our efforts to make sure that we benefit the farming communities in the U.S. Southwest.
Yeah, that's great. You know, AI really is the future of ag tech, you know, and I'm sure you guys have high hopes for the adoption of these sorts of technologies by the growers and or the consultants.
Yeah, one of the roles that I see for us as well is to make sure that we vet somehow like some of the technologies that are being offered to the growers, because it's ag tech is one of those spaces where the technology is often more advanced than the actual science behind it. So there's a lot of stuff that is offered to the growers, but there's not sufficient body of research done to make sure that that's a cost-effective solution for the needs of each grower. So one of the things that A&R, University of California, are doing, are trying to look at these different technologies and compare to one another, and then make sure that they do what they say they're doing, and as well that they are like a good tool for the growers to use.
Definitely. Well, thank you, Ilya, and thank you for talking about this really important subject and for doing this post-interview follow-up here.
Yeah, great. Thanks so much for having me.
Of course.
Our news is coming up next. We will be right back.
Soil fumigation is a critical step to ensure that your orchard gets off to a good start. Trichlor is a pre-plant soil fumigant and is the foundation for a successful pest management system. Targeted pathogens include soil-borne disease and nematodes. Fumigation helps to create a healthy soil environment that allows the plant's root system to flourish. For more information about Trichlor or to schedule an application, contact Trical Incorporated at 669-327-5076 or visit www.trical.com.
Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you.
Here's your news for today. California's state budget will allocate $5.2 billion over 3 years to fund drought relief projects. The money is intended to secure water supplies and implement the 2014 Sustainable Groundwater Management Act. The funding will also go to a state water efficiency program, as well as to the Healthy Soils Program. That effort is intended to improve carbon sequestration in the soil and build up organic matter to help retain water. The Department of Agriculture is rolling out a new insurance option specifically for agricultural producers with small farms who sell locally. The new micro farm policy announced Wednesday simplifies record keeping and covers post-production costs like washing and value-added products. USDA's Risk Management Agency created the new policy based on research directed by the 2018 Farm Bill. It includes feedback from producers who grow for their local communities. Data collection will soon begin for USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service first ever hemp acreage and production survey. Michael Clements reports.
Later this month, USDA NAS will mail survey codes to thousands of potential hemp producers nationwide. Gerald Tillman, National Agricultural Statistics Census and Survey Division Branch Chief, explains the survey.
The Hemp Acreage and Production Survey is basically the very first survey that USDA will be doing for hemp. And our focus is to gather hemp planted acres in open fields, hemp harvested acres in open field, and the uses of hemp, hemp flour for human consumption, hemp for grain for human consumption, hemp for fiber, and hemp for seed, and then anything it's grown for that we're not aware of. And we're looking to gather the total pounds produced and sold for the four different types of uses. Also, hemp is grown under protection. Your greenhouse and nursery operations we will target as well.
Bill Richmond, USDA AMS Domestic Hemp Program Chief, says this inaugural survey will set the benchmark for hemp acreage and production to assist regulatory agencies, producers, state governments, processors, and other key industry entities.
It will really help us to improve our program delivery and our offering of USDA programs across the entire department to the hemp industry, whether it's for risk management products, insurance products, to help us conduct more targeted research around hemp genetics, for example, and really allow us to refine and conduct more targeted outreach and education with hemp growers across the entire country. So we know this is incredibly important, especially for our new and beginning farmers, for our underserved communities, and for our tribal communities as well.
Richmond says it will also serve the hemp industry and growers.
It will give the entire hemp industry excellent insight around who has decided to grow hemp, where the concentrations of hemp growers are in the United States, where producers have found value in terms of whether or not it makes sense for them to be growing hemp for cannabinoids, or if there is more interest in growing hemp for fiber or grain. That will all be available under this new data collection.
Tillman says survey codes for producers to respond online will be mailed October 18th for the 2021 Hemp Acreage and Production Survey.
It appears there's been a bit of a struggle for hemp producers to get things going and get things started. And we intend to do our very best to find out all the facts, not just for USDA, but to help the hemp industry. There's no other way that we can find the facts that's going to support a new industry like this. And likewise with our other surveys, we really encourage producers to report to us. We here at NAS and all of USDA do our best to support our farmers and ranchers.
Results for the survey will be available in 2022. For more information, visit nas.usda.gov/go/hemp. Michael Clements reporting.
The total value of agricultural exports may reach an all-time high in fiscal year 2022, October through September. USDA's Economic Research Service says higher shipments of major categories of commodities, including grains and feeds, oilseeds and livestock, poultry and dairy products, are primarily driving the increase. Total U.S. agricultural export values are projected to reach $177.5 billion in fiscal year 2022. That's up from $173.5 billion in fiscal year 2021. USDA's annual look at small grain production revealed how drought in parts of the country has impacted production and yields of wheat and other crops. Rod Bain reports.
I think the big story here in the small grains is continued evidence of drought.
Agriculture Department Chief Economist Seth Meyer explains that findings in USDA's annual small grain summary somewhat resemble the appearance of corn and soybean yields in production from the September crop reports, in that small grain condition follows a distinct climatic map.
Kind of contrasted north and west of Des Moines, Iowa,
where drought severity has been at extreme levels in many parts of that area,
with everything east of Des Moines, Iowa,
which featured improved, if not ideal, growing conditions. Meyer believes regarding growing regions like the Pacific Northwest and Northern and Central Plains,
that really shows up in what we observe in terms of yields in winter wheat and other wheats compared to last year.
He also acknowledges the forecasted numbers perhaps show some discrepancy. For instance, all wheat production is expected down 10% year over year, with yields down over 5% from last year. Yet area harvested is expected to increase by 1% in 2021. also within various categories, such as spring wheat.
What you're seeing in almost all of them is a widening of the abandoned acres. So as a share of the total, abandoned acres widening, and you have a funny offset, which is actually tends to support yields a little bit when you do that, because the worst of it is the stuff that doesn't get harvested.
So planted acres were slightly down between monthly estimates, and harvested acres were down over 9% month over month, while spring wheat yields were actually up 2 bushels per acre from the previous forecast. However, year-over-year spring wheat yield and production and the significant drops in totals in both reflect the adverse drought conditions in major production states.
We're talking about production numbers that may be the lowest in a decade, or for some states in multiple decades in terms of overall production for those crops.
And the chief economist adds that it is a similar story for barley, oats, and other small grains grown in drought-impacted areas of the northwestern quadrant of the country. Notable yield and production decreases from the previous year and increased crop abandonment. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Department of Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack announced Wednesday an investment of more than $146 million in sustainable agricultural research projects. The projects are aimed at improving a robust, resilient, climate-smart food and agriculture system. The investment comes from the National Institute of Food and Agriculture's Sustainable Agricultural Systems Program. This was supposed to be an off year for California pistachio orchards, but the harvest has been robust. It is expected to meet or exceed 1 billion pounds. That's just below 2020's high yield year total of 1.05 billion pounds. Pistachios rank fourth among California agricultural commodities behind milk, almonds, and grapes. That's your news for today. We will be right back.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcasts, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
Welcome back. The State Water Resources Control Board met Tuesday and discussed the ongoing drought. Eric Ekdahl, the Deputy Director of the State Water Board's Division of Water Rights, discussed several issues. Here's his presentation.
Again, I'll run through some brief updates on where we are with our several watersheds where the board has adopted emergency regulations and curtailments are in place. Starting with the Delta, a brief update on compliance status of the information orders and the certification forms that were sent out in late August. As of October 1st, we have about 75% of recipients that have responded, with about 700 diverters claiming a health and human safety exemption. We've also gotten about 700 non-consumptive use certifications and about 80% compliance, or about 588 enhanced reporting requirements, have submitted that additional requested data that looks at kind of the more real-time or quasi-real-time diversions over the last couple of months and projected diversions into the future. Just a reminder that those results are all available at the linked website on our drought website, or the Delta drought website. As a note, we also issued revised October curtailments on October 1st, and a little bit more discussion there to note that we do revise the curtailments for the Bay Delta watershed every week. We look at the California Nevada River Forecast Center, or CNRFC, which provides essentially 7-day forecasts every week, and we do tweak the level of curtailments depending on the results from that information. And so every week we usually either remove the curtailments for a number of folks, or in some circumstances may need to adjust them and add some more folks back in. So it's a very dynamic number, although right now the curtailments do reach very far back into the priority system. For additional details on how far back, again, we rather than read through every watershed, we'll refer back to this website. We do also have a planned staff technical workshop scheduled for October 20th. We've received some additional input about things like return flow, and a number of diverters have raised questions about how we calculate the depth of curtailment and when we lift those curtailments based on changes in forecast river flows or storm events. And so we would like to raise these issues and discuss them publicly at this October 20th workshop. It will be a virtual meeting, and so there will be, I think, a lot of opportunity for people to join in and offer input. And we can provide additional details on that on our website, where there already is information. And an information item went out via our LIRIS, I think, 2 days ago. So stay tuned there, and we'll have some additional updates, I think, in the near future on this technical approach. Next slide, please. An update on Mill and Deer Creek, which were the subject of emergency regulation adoption meeting at the last board meeting. The Office of Administrative Law did approve these emergency regulations late yesterday. The bullet here says curtailment orders are anticipated for October 5th through 8th. Some late breaking developments yesterday. The Department of Fish and Wildlife is continuing to meet with diverters in these watersheds about the possibility of a further voluntary drought agreement. And so we're actually going to postpone the issuance of these curtailment orders, at least until we hear back on the status and how those discussions have gone. But it may be that we implement then or send out the curtailment orders next week as opposed to this week, or not at all if there are, in fact, effective discussions. Regardless, because of the adoption of the regulations, the minimum flow requirements would begin October 15th. Next slide, please. In the Russian River, we do have some somewhat positive news. Reach losses are improving at about 48 CFS. And so if you remember back to the last update in late September, you know, based on where you are within the river, there are various segments that are losing more water than gaining. In fact, at this point, it's all losing water. And that reach loss can, you know, amount to a fairly high volume, over 100 CFS in some times of the year. And so the fact that it's come down to about 48 is a very positive development. About 76% of right holders who have received a curtailment order have responded. Here we have about 103 human health and safety responses and about 27 petitions to exceed the 55 gallons per person per day limit that's included in the human health and safety adjustments. We also do adjust curtailments in the Lower Russian River, although we do it monthly based on the time steps there for the annual diversion data. And the most recent update was earlier this last week for the month of October. We also do have the interactive response tracker on our website powered through the Microsoft Power BI dashboard. That being said, Lake Mendocino in the Upper River or Upper Russian River watershed was a little bit below 15,000 acre feet as of earlier this week, and it continues to drop at about 900 or more acre feet per week. And so it continues to be drawn down farther and farther. You know, last year, only about 5,000 acre feet accumulated in Lake Mendocino, but it was starting at a much higher position. So it was starting at about 39,000 acre feet and rose to about 44, 45,000 acre feet and has been going down since. And so if this next water year is at all like the previous two water years, the storage levels in Lake Mendocino continue to be a significant concern. You know, if you're only starting at 10,000 and you raise it to 15,000, it's about where it is now. So things continue to be very challenging. And the plus side is that the watershed is very rain dependent, and you know, a couple big storms can go a long way towards adding significant volume to the reservoir. So we'll just have to stay tuned and see. Next slide, please. In the Scott and Shasta River, curtailment orders were issued on September 9th and mailed out on the 10th. We're currently reviewing and acting on petitions in the health and human safety certifications. As a note, we will likely issue additional information orders for three tributaries to the Shasta River in the next week or two. Wairika Creek was never covered by the Water Master District since the inception of the adjudication for about 90 years. Willow Creek was dropped from the Water Master Service in, I think it says 1935. Julian Creek has not been water mastered for at least 85 years. And it turns out there are about 200 or so listed diversions in the Shasta River decree or the adjudication. But in fact, we have only records for four or five of them. And so we have this huge missing set of data that these information orders are intended to help bring into the process and help track and understand, are these diversions still in place? Do they still exist? And if so, where are they and what's their level of water use? So those again will likely go out in the next week or two. Next slide, please. Quick note on Shasta flows. The flows for the curtailment, when the curtailment went into effect, set a September flow target of about 50 CFS. And that's that dark red line you can see kind of go through the lower part of the middle of the graph. The blue line shows measured stream flow, and around September 18th or so, shortly after the issuance of the curtailment orders, flows in fact did rise above that flow objective for the curtailment regulation. On October 1st, that flow target jumps up to 125 CFS. So you can see that step in the red line. Flows that we're observing over the last couple of days have not reached 125 CFS yet. Many adjudications, though, did cease diversion at the end of September. And so we're kind of closely watching to see what the next steps are there to help reach that 125 CFS flow target. And a note that Chinook were observed entering the system as of the end of September, about 2,800 adult fish had been observed. Scott River flows are not quite reaching their target. In fact, they're still pretty low. The flows remain significantly below the target of both 33 for September and 40 CFS for October, although there are indications that groundwater levels are rising.
Again, we're hearing from Eric Ekdahl, Deputy Director of the State Water Board Division of Water Rights. We will be right back.
Agrimiora Nursery is the premier nursery in California. Whether it's almonds, walnuts, pistachios, prunes, or olives, Agrimiora has been the grower's source for over 20 years and is the home of Root Pack R Almond, Grizzly Walnut, and the North American plants UCB1 and Platinum Clonal Pistachio Rootstocks. As the worldwide leader in super high-density almonds, olives, and prunes, Agrimiora can show you how to cut costs and increase yields with their super high-density rootstock Root Pack 20. For more information or to schedule a site visit, contact a representative at 530-812-3398 today. Does your crop have iron chlorosis? AgroPlante has a solution for you. Traditionally, chelated iron has limitations that AgroPlante's Iron Force does not. Iron Force, with its EDDHA chelation technology, can turn your plant's iron chlorosis from yellow to green in as little as 15 days, despite unbalanced soil pH and calcareous soils. From organic certified to conventional micronutrients, AgroPlante has the product for you. Call 559-498-0388 or visit us at www.agroplante.com. The California Walnut Board and Commission provides value to the California walnut industry by working together with growers and handlers to advance the industry. Together, the California Walnut Board and Commission are helping to protect, develop, and grow California walnuts domestically and internationally. The California Walnut Board provides funding and strategic direction on walnut production and post-harvest research designed to help support the industry and promote California walnuts. To learn more, visit our website at walnuts.org. Together we grow.
Welcome back. We continue now with Eric Ekdahl, Deputy Director of the State Water Board's Division of Water Rights.
You know, we have gotten a lot of questions about how we respond to curtailments and whether or not we're going to lift them based on upcoming storm events or just changes in flow. And the CNRFC, the California-Nevada River Forecast Center, provides daily updates that we do track each day. And we watch very carefully within the division for what the projected precipitation and response in terms of stream flow is based on the information provided by that center. And we are prepared to rapidly and quickly respond by lifting curtailments at the appropriate priority based on the projected responses from that forecast center. And so there are some indications of a storm event coming late Wednesday into Thursday, and division staff are tracking that carefully. And we are prepared, should the data warrant it, to lift the curtailments at the appropriate level. And just to note that we do that via the LIRIS and our website and the email listserv that goes out to the affected parties and those that have signed up. And so just again, a reminder and encouragement for those that are watching or those that are watching that are aware of other people who are affected by the curtailments to make sure that you've signed up for that LIRIS and that email listserv, because that is our primary way of getting this rapid information out to the public. We'll also post that information on our website. And so checking back on the drought website frequently when these storm events occur is another very effective way to track whether curtailments are still in place for your priority of right. And so I think maybe let's pause there before we go into Division of Drinking Water and see if there are any questions on the water rights component. And then we'll hand it over to Eric in the Division of Drinking Water.
Okay, I do have some questions, but first we'll turn to board members. Any questions? Okay, so Mr. Ekdahl, looking for some additional information on the topic that you just mentioned, and that is lifting curtailments. So I really appreciate ensuring us that the division is on top of this, but if you could just talk a little bit more about it. So what about sub watersheds and, you know, maybe some additional precipitation in sub watersheds where it may not be system wide, and your ability to be granular and responsive, you know, to respond quickly to these storm events. I do think that there seems to be some concern that, you know, maybe we're not interested in lifting curtailments. And, I haven't seen any evidence of that, but just want to make sure that folks understand that we really are interested in being able to divert for public water agencies to be able to divert water to storage. So if you could talk a little bit about that. And then also on the just sort of the logistics. I understand that on a LIRIS list, you know, that you're able to send that out quickly, but what about logistics on the receiving end? If you have not yet, you know, sort of pulled the trigger, what is your ability to be responsive to concerns where, you know, maybe in a subwatershed, there's an agency that believes that we should have pulled the trigger? How are you able to be responsive to those questions, you know, over the weekend and after hours?
Right. So I was trying to write down the question as we go. And if I forget something, please remind me and I'll circle back to it. I think I want to talk about the logistics part of it first. You know, staff are constantly watching whether it's after hours, whether it's during the weekend, whether it's during holidays. But I think the main approach that we're going to take is, frankly, to be very liberal in terms of when we lift, so that we're lifting with sufficient time in advance so that we have the opportunity to message and communicate to the potentially affected watersheds, you know, at least a day in advance, potentially, you know, longer if the data suggests that's the case. So making ourselves available, making sure that our, you know, staff are monitoring the emails 24/7, essentially, when the events warrant it, and making sure that, you know, our phone numbers are available for people that do have questions and just, you know, that there's constantly a point of contact. The question about sub watersheds is admittedly challenging. When we approached the water availability methodology this year, that we've had the, the template and the mechanisms out since May, the approach does already break the Bay Delta region down into sub watersheds. So we do have the ability already to look at, you know, kind of specific rivers and the watersheds within them. But it does get challenging when you may have, you know, an isolated one single thunderstorm that sits over a mountain valley and you get, you know, just this insane amount of precipitation in a very localized way. That issue, though, is largely smoothed out when you do look at the whole watershed as kind of one, or even sub-watershed as a particular system, because you do have to look at the overall supply, both, you know, downstream of that reservoir and within the delta itself too. There are very senior demands within the delta, and trying to estimate the total supply within the total system and then subdivide that out into a sub-watershed, it's challenging. The CNRFC data does allow us to try and do that. And so we are able to look at the sub-watershed scale, but will we be able to capture, you know, a very isolated one single substream of a very small sub-watershed? Probably not. That being said, though, again, we feel confident in the methodology, and because of the scope and the scale and the approach that we're going to take in terms of, again, this liberal lifting of curtailments when these storm systems are coming through, we believe that we should be able to capture the vast majority of the water that comes from these storms and, you know, create the scenario where the public water supply systems or irrigation districts or whomever are able to capture that water. And I think one thing maybe to even say as a top line statement, you know, the idea that we would somehow leave curtailments in place during one of the most challenging water years on record, if not the most challenging water year on record, and somehow not, you know, try and let the water districts or suppliers capture that water when it's critically needed, just doesn't really make sense on its face. I think there's some concern that we'd be prioritizing the projects instead of these very senior rights. And, you know, that's not what the methodology states. That's not the intent or the vision, I think, of what the curtailment regulations the board adopted. And, you know, frankly, the goal is to open up the curtailments and lift the curtailments, maybe not entirely, but in pieces as the water and hydrology allows, as priority allows, so that we can capture every drop that we possibly can during these storms, because we just don't know what the rest of the water year is going to be like. And so it actually makes it critically important that we do be as flexible and as liberal as we possibly can with lifting the curtailments, so that we do have the opportunity to get that water when it's there. I think I'll pause there.
Yeah, and thank you for that. I think it's important and it bears repeating because of the critical need to move water into storage. And, you know, I think that's part of what went into the thinking of the curtailment order and the ability to lift. And so thank you for that. Just one follow-up question, though. Downstream senior demands, what sort of demands, and maybe you're talking just generally, but at this time of year, I'm really not aware of much in the way of downstream demand in the Delta in particular.
There's always some, and we do have that data available. I believe it's in our spreadsheets that, you know, we do have published on our website, and it is part of the methodology. And, you know, we just earlier this week, we're kind of looking at, well, in a specific watershed, what is the downstream demand relative to what has been reported by the diverters? So again, that's maybe worth emphasizing that we're basing this off what the reporters have reported to us. Sometimes we do try to correct it where we think there is an obvious mistake, and we've documented that. That's part of the methodology. But you know, even in this year, in one of the San Joaquin tributaries, there's still thousands of acre feet of demand the farther you go downstream. as has been reported to us. So we do try to accommodate that. We do try and look at that, and we do integrate that into the curtailment methodology.
So maybe on balance with you being liberal and maybe some of these statements have come in where they've overstated. So just encourage everybody that has concerns to participate in the workshop so that these issues can be worked through. So, all right. Thank you for that.
You can find more from the meeting on the board's website. That is our show for today. This is the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson from the JCS Marketing Team. Thanks for listening.